Welcome to my Bob Thurman podcast. I'm so grateful some good friends enabled me to present them to you. If you enjoy them and find them useful, please think of becoming a member of Tibet House US to help preserve Tibetan culture. Tibet House is the Dalai Lama's cultural center in America. All best wishes. Have a great day.
This is episode 107, Stress Relief for Buddhists.
We do have our little bell today. Let's bring it over. From Eheji. What?
I would need cities to reach it over there.
Yeah. It's actually from Eheji, from Dogen's master. Out in the 80s. Well, it's dangerous to lower stress on Friday evening. One wants to fall asleep. I thought we would read, I would just read together with you. I've been enjoying very much this fall because I've been teaching again at Columbia. I was on sabbatical for 2 years. And I teach an undergraduate course, Introduction to Indo-Tibetan Buddhism. And so at the beginning of the year, every year, I get to reread the Buddha's life and some of the sutras about the Buddha. And I always enjoy reading the Pali suttas, as they call them, and try to read a few new ones that I haven't read. The Buddhist literature is so huge. So enormously huge. And as I grow older and I read more about it, the more amazed I am by the Buddha, at least as recorded and remembered by people. The Pali Suttas in particular are said to have not been written for maybe 700-800 years.
There was like 300,
400. Well, they say maybe Ashoka's time, somebody, you know, which would be 300, But then other people say they weren't actually written until they were in Sri Lanka and so on. You know. Quite a long time, even into the CE centuries, common era centuries. But, you know, it's, who knows exactly. But the key is that in India and Buddha's time, spiritual teachings and religious things, it was considered not a good idea to write them down. Writing was, because these people had prodigious memories. And they could remember, they would hear a speech by the Buddha, a teaching by the Buddha, or a dialogue with someone by the Buddha. You often talk in dialogue. And they would then be able to repeat it, many of them immediately, like if it was an hour talk, they would repeat that hour talk just like a tape recorder. And then over the centuries, they had certain people who had certain things memorized. And then when they would grow older, they would assign several young monks to that person, and then they would download that thing, and they would kept it alive over many centuries like that, which had already been done in India by the Vedic Brahmins. It was already a thing they had in India. The Vedas was considered an absolute sacrilege to write the Vedas down, and they had tremendous laws of meter and rhyme and emphasis, inflection and stress on different syllables. So that it was made it easier to remember. So I'm just saying that it is possible that it is really the way the Buddha did talk and what he did say. And he's so amazing, the Buddha. He really totally is amazing. Anyway, this is I've been reading the Digha Nikaya, which means the Digha Nikaya, the long discourses of the Buddha. But I left my copy. And so I get to read it every year with the students anyway. And I fall into the time of the Buddha. That's very, very relaxing and nice. Really, it is really wonderful. So I thought I would read one sutra of this kind. Thus, it begins traditionally, and I almost always can't help criticizing translations. I was hoping not to criticize this translation, but I have to. They all the evam maya shrutam ekasmin samaye. The all Buddhist sutras begin like that. Evam maya shrutam ekasmin samaye. And thus, did I hear on a certain occasion, is actually the way it begins. But people tend to always translate, thus did I hear, period. Then on a certain occasion, such and such happened. They break it, you know, they make a break. And because they're thinking of once upon a time, you know. And they think that should precede then the setting and so on. But in the tradition, actually, it shouldn't. Because the key point about it is that I did hear this on a specific occasion. Thus did I hear on a certain occasion, is actually what it said. And that is a sign or a symbol that this was exactly what came from the Buddha. You know, on a specific occasion, somebody did hear that from the Buddha. So thus have I heard, they say, or did I hear on a certain occasion. You know, but Bhikkhu Bodhi, I love Bhikkhu Bodhi, but he does this on one occasion, the Lord. And the Buddha, the Blessed One, I'll just read what they said. It's almost impossible for me to do it, but Bhagavan, his name, Bhagavan doesn't really mean Blessed One. He's the Blessing One. He's blessing others. He's not being blessed. But anyway, the Blessing One was living in the Kuru country at a town of the Kurus named Kamasadama. There he addressed the bhikkhus thus. Bhikkhus, venerable sir, they replied. The Blessing One said this. Bhikkhus, and bhikkhus are, you know what a bhikkhu means, one who lives on alms, that means. Person who doesn't have to go out and make a living. They just go and get a free lunch. They go to the kitchen and the people give them lunch. So bhikkhus, this is the direct path for the purification of beings, for the surmounting of sorrow and lamentation, for the disappearance of pain and grief, for the for the disappearance of stress, for the attainment of the true way, for the realization of Nibbana, namely the four foundations of mindfulness. What are the four? Here, bhikkhus. A bhikkhu abides contemplating the body as a body, ardent, fully aware and mindful, having put away covetousness and grief for the world. He abides contemplating feelings as feelings, ardent, fully aware and mindful, having put away covetousness and grief for the world. He abides contemplating mind as mind, ardent, fully aware and mindful, having put away covetousness and grief for the world. He abides contemplating mind objects as mind objects, ardent, fully aware and mindful, having put away covetousness and grief for the world. So those are the four foundations of mindfulness. You know, upasthana, I prefer foci of mindfulness, you know, focuses of mindfulness or foci of mindfulness. Upasthana means placing the mind towards something, you know, rather than a foundation or a basis, a focus of mindfulness. And how, bhikkhus, does a bhikkhu abide contemplating the body as a body? Here a bhikkhu gone to the forest, or gone to Menla, or gone to the root of a tree, or to an empty hut, sits down. Having folded his legs crosswise, set his body erect, and established mindfulness in front of him, ever mindful he breathes in, mindful he breathes out. Breathing in long, he understands, I breathe in long. Or breathing out long, he understands, I breathe out long. Breathing in short, he understands, I breathe in short. Or breathing out short, he understands, I breathe out short. He trains or learns, as I prefer, he learns thus, I shall breathe in, experiencing the whole body of breath. He learns thus, I shall breathe out, experiencing the whole body of breath. That is, breathing in, feel the whole body gaining the energy, the breath, not just the breath into the lungs, but the energy coming in, the oxygen, the energy coming in from the breath and pervading the entire body. Because the subtle energy goes in the bloodstream and goes everywhere. He learns thus, I shall breathe in, tranquilizing the bodily formation. He trains thus, I shall breathe out, tranquilizing the bodily formation. Just as a skilled turner or his apprentice, when making a long turn, understands, I make a long turn, or when making a short turn, understands, I make a short turn. So too, breathing in long, a bhikkhu understands, I breathe in long. He learns thus, I shall breathe out, tranquilizing the body formation. In this way, he abides contemplating the body as a body internally, or she abides contemplating the body as a body externally, or she abides contemplating the body as a body both internally and externally, or else he abides contemplating in the body its arising factors, its causal factors, or he abides contemplating in the body its vanishing factors, what in the body is disappearing. Or he abides contemplating in the body both its arising and vanishing factors. Or else mindfulness that there is a body is simply established in him to the extent necessary for bare knowledge and mindfulness. And he abides independent, not clinging to anything in the world. That is how a bhikkhu abides contemplating the body as a body. Shall we do that together now? We just did, and now we're doing it in the context of the Buddha's instruction, where you, instead of simply counting, you first take note of how you're breathing. I think it's sort of like four steps. You breathe in and out sort of slowly, and you take note of the fact that you're breathing in slowly and out slowly. And you lose yourself just in doing those things. Breathing in slowly and breathing out slowly. When you're feeling stressed out, even when you're not formally meditating, you can always withdraw from whatever's stressing you out and take a deep breath. Actually, it's even like a proverb, take a deep breath. You know, when someone delivers a shocking news and they tell them, now just take a deep breath. And they say, it's just the same instruction. And when you do that a couple of times, and then you sort of go back to being natural, it seems that your natural breath is a short breath. So then you let yourself have a couple of shallow breaths and take note that you're having shallow breaths. And then the third step is you breathe in where you feel it filling your whole body. So you feel the breathing in as if it going down to the very tip of your toes. And fills your whole chest and diaphragm and also down into the pelvis and then down as if the energy is flowing down the legs, going out through the shoulders into the arms, going up into the little tips of your hair. So you imagine that the subtle energy in the air, which is what gives us the energy from the air, which we nowadays call oxygen, then going through the alveoli into the lungs, into the bloodstream, and then the blood molecules picking up the little packages of oxygen and sending those everywhere in the body. And as we breathe out, then the whatever is cleansing or whatever used up energy is there, we exhale and return to the plant world that likes it. Of course, the energy we're getting is coming from the plant world, which makes the oxygen through its photosynthesis. So feel that your breath is filling up your whole body. And now we take a fourth step where, as we breathe, being aware of its length or shortness, and being aware that the energy we are taking in is pervading the entire body, we then breathe, being mindful that we are tranquilizing or making calm our body and mind. As we do that. So as we breathe in, it nourishes and calms body and mind. As we breathe out, it becomes like a sigh of relief that our body and mind are calmed and tranquilized. We let go of stress. We let go of worry and flurry, as they translate very cutely. And we feel very balanced and stable and energized. So now we breathe in, and with each breath in and out, we become more and more calm. Now we can add one other dimension that's not in this sutra, but we can remind ourselves that there are many, many beings around us in the world. There's a few in the room with us, and then there are many, many outside in other towns and cities and houses. And there are all kinds of animals and insects and invisible creatures. Also in the sky and in the under the earth. And as we draw in our breath, we can imagine that they are giving us energy, and the energy is coming from them in a form that energizes us. And as we exhale, we are sending out to them the calm and the energy that we have within us. So we become aware of the reciprocating breathing of ourselves and others. And we right away practice this mindfulness and this calming and this awareness of the body and this tranquilizing of the body in a field of awareness in which we include other beings. And we send to them our goodwill, our blessing, our love for them, wish for them to be happy, our compassion for them not to be unhappy, so that we combine a sense of connection with others, with our self-calming of ourselves. We've sort of created a six-step process. So it's first just being aware of the length of our breathing. I'm breathing in a deep breath, long breath. I'm breathing out a long breath. I'm breathing in a short breath. Breathing out a short breath. I'm bringing in a breath, an energy that fills my entire body. And I'm bringing out a breath that frees my entire body. I'm bringing in a breath that calms my body. And I'm bringing out a breath that calms my body. And as I breathe in, I receive the gift of energy from other beings. And as I breathe out, I give to them the good energy that I have received. Then this one. Going further, we contemplate the body internally. We have an image in our mind, of course, of our anatomy. So we sort of feel the body as if we are within the body, as if we are the interior of our body. And the more sense we have of our anatomy, the more of an amazing, complex, extraordinary appreciation we have of this body. And then we can have an image of our body like externally, as if we were seeing ourselves from outside. Acknowledging our connection with the world around us. For example, now, internally in the body, I have a kind of like a slight ringing sound in my ears. I hear the wind outside, the aggregate movement of leaves in the trees. Where is that, inside my body or outside my body? I realize the interfusion of my inner hearing and the sounds that are outside. since our eyes are closed or partially closed, we don't have a very broad visual field. But when we see the floor in front of us, or we have visual images in the mind of something outside of us, where is the boundary of the inside and the outside? Smell and taste and touch are more almost very close to the senses. They don't feel very far outside. And of course, mind and its mental objects are incredibly diverse. And we can think of Washington, D.C., or like Boston, or New York, or California, or France, or Tibet, or China, or Burma. Instantly the mind can go there in the plane of mind. So as we think in that way, our body feels more connected to the nature all around, at least our images of the nature all around. And we feel more interconnected with the world. Without becoming attached to it and without worrying about it. And as we sit here, of course, then there are things about our body that are, as we breathe in, the body expands and oxygen enters the bloodstream. And as we take in sense experiences, the mind fills up with stimuli. So these are arising factors or causal factors. And as we breathe out, carbon leaves the body and moisture is leaving the body all the time as we are dehydrating. And maybe very subtle energies of our mental patterns and our emotional feelings are also emanating outward. But these are vanishing factors. So we begin to become aware of our body as a constantly changing and impermanent process, taking things in from the outer environment and giving things back out across a very, very vaguely and not sharply delineated boundary, which is also kind of relaxing to feel connected to things. We lessen the stress of feeling that we are isolated. From our external connections. Then we think about time. We directed our minds into this meditation because we read something recorded from thousands of years ago, statements made by the Shakyamuni Buddha. So somehow his ideas and his voice reached to us across thousands of years of gap. And in another sense, of course, since the Buddha's body is the body of the teaching, the Dhammakaya, even in Theravada, therefore, and the Buddha is even, and in all forms of Buddhism, Buddha is known as a being that is present in all three times, all the time. So the Buddha is present in every moment of his future, which is this moment, or whatever this moment is. So as we breathe in and out, we can imagine that the Buddha's there in all his shining radiance. And as we breathe in, we're breathing in the light of blessing from the Buddha. With each inhalation, not only are we filling up with the energy of the prana, we're also filling up with the light of the blessing of the Buddha, and actually all the Buddhas of past, even present, and future. Since by becoming Buddhas, they step into a, they enter an awareness where all moments of time are equally immediate to them. So we bring in this wonderful light of blessing as we breathe in, and we feeling our connection to enlightened beings, not only just to other regular beings. And we feel so energized and blessed by that blessing that when we breathe out, we share that blessing and energy with all of the beings, ordinary beings around us, our loved ones, ones we are merely barely acquainted with, and our very unloved ones, that those that we think of as enemies. So in our just our breathing, we become a channel of the blessings of the enlightened beings and their positive energy and outlook and health and healing. And as we breathe out, we share that relief and that nourishment and that succor with other beings. We radiate out to them as we receive from the Buddhas. Kind of fun. Actually, the three baskets of Buddhism, how many of you are very veteran, know a lot about Buddhism? Okay. Only two very veterans? And how many are sort of new to it, kind of? Okay. So about even, and then there's some who are not letting on. Well, there's famous thing in Buddhism, the literature of Buddhism is divided into what they call the three baskets, the three pitakas, which are the baskets of the Vinaya, which means usually translated the discipline, the sutra, which means the discourse, actually, meaning Buddha's actual discourses, and then the Abhidhamma, or Abhidharma, which means the organized, sort of systematized themes and teachings and insights given in the discourses. Sort of, in other words, the content of the discourse is made into a manual or an organized treatise, and also with critical reflection and analysis sort of thing. And those correspond to what are called the three higher educations. People often translate as trainings, but I don't like to do, because I think they're more like, instead of just making one conform to some rote behavior, like a training, they're rather more bringing out of oneself one's sort of good qualities and wisdom and so on. So more like education. And these are called education in ethics, and education in mind or meditation or concentration, and education in wisdom, which means the critical, clear, insightful, experiential knowledge of the nature of things. So the sutra, which like we were reading, we started out by reading a passage from a sutra, that corresponds to the education in meditation, actually. which I think is because when the Buddha spoke, people would enter into his state of mind. You know, and so they would automatically get the fruit of his meditation. He would convey by language. And of course, by being in the Buddha's field, which was always an amazing thing to be in. You know, he would share his vibes with people, a Buddha, in the most amazing way. There's so many stories of people coming and meeting the Buddha, and they're all distraught and stressed out and freaked out and like worried and like or angry or many things like that. And then they come to Buddha. One, in fact, the first lay disciple, the Yapi Yashas, or Yesas, I think in Pali, Yashas his name. And he was all mad because he'd been robbed by some girls. He'd been partying with the other yuppies, and they'd been drugged and rolled. And they were down to their underwear running through the forest looking for the girls. And the Buddha was meditating in the grove with his other disciples, and the young yuppie said, "Have you seen some girls carrying some jewels and some silks and some things, you know, like my wallet, you know, my American Express card?" And the Buddha says, "Would you rather find the girls and your clothes, or would you rather find yourself?" And so this, like, distraught and hungover guy says, "Oh, myself, of course." Sits down and starts meditating. So I've always thought that must only be because the field of the Buddha's presence was so strong, you know, that it actually made people like come down to a deeper place in themselves just by being in his presence. Like Dalai Lama has that effect, you know, on people. Mm-hmm. Okay. Tries to tell us that all we are is a body. And therefore all there is to life is just feeding the body, consuming things for the body, beautifying the body, even healing the body, avoiding the troubles and pains of the body, and then even locating the body in a nice tomb after death, or cremating it after a nice service, putting on a tuxedo and some rouge and makeup and embalming it or whatever they do. Whole obsession with the body that we have. But all cultures have had it, you know, and then even fantasies like in the Abrahamic traditions, I think basically post-Egypt, I think it came from Egypt, that fantasy about making the body immortal, you know, by putting it in a pyramid or whatever, you know. Last judgment, the rotten old body hops up. If you're lucky, gets to go hang out and sing in the heavenly choir. If you're unlucky, gets to go to the barbecue. Completely cuckoo idea. I'm sorry, I apologize, but really cuckoo. Meanwhile, everyone is long gone from that body and has been in many, many bodies. And we'll be in another body any time. But meanwhile, we have this body. So what are we doing with it? Well, you all are doing the great thing by being on retreat, being a temporary bhikkhu or bhikkhuni. And looking into your quality of life. And looking to understand the fact that we live in this terribly stressed out situation, which is really the industrial situation. There was one Tibetan Lama once in 1976, he came to America, he passed away since then, but his reincarnation is now about 25 or something, the Nechung Rinpoche, not the oracle, but the Lama of the Nechung Monastery, you know, not the medium one, you know, but the reincarnation. And that Nechung Rinpoche in the 70s who came here as the Dalai Lama's representative, and a special focus his was meeting different native people. We went to the Iroquois and the Hopi and the Lakota. Didn't get to the Lakota, somehow too turbulent at that time. But other tribes. And anyway, then when he was leaving after having been here about 6 weeks traveling around the country, he was in New York, you know, getting on a flight in a couple of days, and there was a dinner by one of the hosts. And he was asked by the host, in front of all the people who had gotten to know him, and he was very nice, and people liked him a lot. And they asked him, "Well, Rinpoche, how did you like America? How do you like America?" And he said, "Oh, it's quite interesting and very nice." He said, "But, I have to say, to speak frankly, it's a bit too much like communist China." Because this particular Rinpoche had been in the 50s. He'd been with the delegation of the Dalai Lamas that went down at Mao's invitation, to visit Beijing and spent a year. Some of them spent a year or two there. Because Mao was trying to woo the Tibetans and pretending that they would get great benefits by becoming communists and joining China and all this, Wasn't pretending that Tibet had always belonged to China, not to the Tibetans. It would have been pointless. But he was luring them to join them. And so he'd lived there. And then people said, "Well, how can you say that? How can it be like communist China?" People were freaking out. And he said, "You're much more wealthy." At that time we were. "And you have nice cars and houses and things," he says. And when I've been visiting, I've stayed in, people who are well off in their houses, and very nice people, very friendly. I like them and they like me. He said, "But I hardly got to visit with them, because from morning till night, breakfast, lunch, and dinner, they was like, the phone was ringing and they were calling people and they were like rushing around here and there, and they were like, worrying about this and that. And they hardly ever had a minute to talk to me." And in China, people had all these, when I was there in the 50s, they had these work brigades, and people were sweeping the streets or killing the sparrows or destroying the bugs or marching around hither and thither, the people. So in neither country does anybody have even a moment of free time. He said, "So that's what it reminded me of, communist China." People were so shocked. And he said, "In Tibet, for all of our problems and for our lack of wealth in some cases and lack of facilities of different kinds," he said, "and we also work very hard and study hard and plant the crops and whatever in the villages and thresh the harvest and build buildings and do things, but there would be weeks on end with nothing to do. And we would hang out, or we would say mantras, or we would chat or drink tea and weave something, and we would just be so relaxed. And I missed that," he said. So stress is, we were on stress, right? So, what good does it do to us to have like two cars and this and that when we rush around? And we're constantly preoccupied with saving the world, or we're ruining the world, or we're feeling guilty because what we own does ruin the world. We had this, anyway, never mind, but I'll stay away from politics for the morning anyway. So this is the terrible stress that we have. So the wonderful gift of the Buddha Dharma is not an invitation to be a Buddhist, but to simplify our life, to be a retreatant, to understand the value of reducing this terrible preoccupations and proliferations. Prapanja, prapanja literally means, panja means five, and prapanja means to make five out of one. Really where it comes from, prapanja, proliferate, make five things out of one thing, then multiply by five, 25, then 625, and go on and on like that. And papanja, I guess, in Pali, right? And they don't use the pra. So it means super five, prapanja. Pra means super. Therefore, looking at the body, When I was forced to study meditation as a young monk, proto-monk and then monk, it was a revelation to me. I had been to a supposedly wonderful school in New York called St. Bernard's, which was a British-style thing, learned Latin in the third grade, French and Latin both, two languages in the third grade. They didn't teach us Greek, though, which sucked. I was annoyed about that. I wanted to learn Greek. And, you know, Shakespeare plays in the fourth grade and all this kind of thing. And then Exeter, you know, little princeling school, waspy princeling school. You know, keep you up till 2 a.m. doing homework, you know. People collapse and can barely go to college when they finish it. They're so overworked. It's really dreadful. And then super gung-ho hockey teams, lacrosse teams, and all this. You know. So I'd been, and yet I had no idea. And I'd been to Harvard for a couple of years. And all of that, I had no idea what a kidney was or what it did. I had no idea where my liver was. It could have been in my ear for as long as I knew. I kind of knew the heart was supposed to be beating, you know, and that there was two lungs, or that what they did, and you know, the whole chemistry. And you know, I was not a pre-med, of course, but even basic anatomy, they didn't bother to tell you about that, you know, because you're basically just like you're supposed to be a good, happy wasp, deferring gratification and charging forward on the football field. You know what I mean? And then to conquer the world, you know, or maintain its conquest, or conquer a corporation, or conquer women, or you know, the whole thing was conquer. Just complete asinine nothing, and then learn to live with stress, you know, and learn to bear a lot of stress. And never mind that you're going to have a heart attack at 38 and lose your first marriage, and then have like three more trophy wives before finally the bypasses, they run out of like things to connect the different like pacemakers to. I mean, what an absurd culture, this. That's industrialization, you know. So you're all trapped in that in one level or another. We all are. Even we get to be Buddhists. It's Sharon is the mindfulness person, and she's traveling everywhere. This train and that. She's got her cell phone, worrying about the ring. And I'm much worse, even. I'm trying to translate. They told me, even by knowing my personality, my Buddhist teachers told me, yeah, you have to translate the Denjor. That's 3,644 Buddhist books about how to calm down and like notice on your kidney. So I have to translate them all from Tibetan and Sanskrit and then maybe into Chinese and Russian and whatever. So, you know, they know how to handle stress in the sense of people who are stress junkies, give them a lot of things to do. And we're all like that. So what a gift, you know, to spend a few days to be like a vacation. And they have that too, you know. You could be, you know, people think Buddhist monk, shave your head, have your robe, drop out, change your name, leave your family, you know, like really something dire, horrible thing. You have to be really practically at death's door to want to do it. But actually in Asia, it was considered a huge privilege. It's like joining the MacArthur Foundation, you know, having a permanent research grant or something. I mean, it's like completely the privilege, and they considered a total wonderful thing. And everybody honored it, and people begged to be able to do it, you know. And just because they couldn't get a date on Saturday night, it was like a big relief. Why do they care, you know? They're having a date with themselves by relaxing, feeling the bliss come out of their own bodies, you know, without having to pump up a little genitally organized sexuality, which leads to, like, paying tuitions in colleges and schools and having teenage rebellions and, like, have to earn more money and being scolded by your wife and whatever, you know, or husband, you know. Samsaric life, you know, not having to bother with it. So we're just, you can be monk or nun for the day. You go and you get, you clip off just a little tiny bit of hair, and you put on a robe, and you hang out, you don't eat after lunch, and you observe whatever and spend your day meditating, and then you don't eat then from lunchtime till the following dawn. And until that dawn, the next dawn, you are a monk or a nun, you're a retreatant, you're a bhikkhu, a mendicant. And you get that taste of that kind of release and relief. And you just drop out. You just don't think about all those worries and problems. And you just, they're there, and you just leave them there for just a day, you know. Because, of course, you have to go back to them if you're a lay person. You have all these responsibilities to others, and to yourself, and to the government. all of these things. And the idea of being able to drop out of it all is a huge transformative thing. And, you know, the Buddha would walk around in India, and he would just walk through town, and people would see this guy who was, like, relaxed, you know, smiling, happy to eat whatever people gave him, you know, ready to, like, you know, answer a question or something, but really very cheerful and happy. And people would just, like, drop their cooking pots and want to leave, you know. So that's why he was a little nervous about women joining the order in their own order, you know, because everybody was celibate, because they came in such droves, you know, because their life was tougher, still is, you know, because they're more oppressed, you know, and pushed into, like, Deepa Ma, right, married at 12. She was lucky she fell in love with that husband. Often they get forced to be married to some grisly character, you know. They have no choice in the matter. And then they work and work. And then similarly, people are, then and then, you know, I translated the Book of the Dead some years ago at people's request. I was kind of not interested in doing it that initially either, but when I did, it was a wonderful thing. And then I had a kind of insight about our culture from doing that, because doing it was such a relief. In other words, being aware of the death and the death process and looking at life as a moment in an evolutionary continuum, just by becoming familiar with the worldview of people who realize that it's illogical and irrational and the worst form of blind faith to assume that your consciousness is nothing and just by dying you won't be here. So therefore you don't have to worry about that, and all your worry is focused on what you do in this life, you know, and how you take care of your body in this life, because all you are is a body. And you, when you begin to look at the death process and look at the mechanism of death, you realize how completely illusory and false that idea is, and completely irrational. That your awareness, which is an energy continuum, you can definitely testify to that, that your awareness is some kind of energy continuum. That you agree with Descartes on that one. And, you know, you don't necessarily agree with him that it's some fixed absolute thing, but you agree that it's there as far as you're concerned, and it's energy. And once you do, then no energy can just become nothing. Energy always makes more energy. You know, it goes on and on. You know. And it may dissipate and come back together and intensify, but it always has a continuum. So when I realized that, then I began to wonder, well, why is it that the Tibetan people can live in a culture, in an awareness, let's say, that they're definitely going to die all their lives, and it's not considered a frightening or a bad thing, or, I mean, it is considered frightening because it's a strange transition, but it's not considered bad to be aware of it. Although, and then there is a strange phenomenon, which is that the Tibetans claim that the so-called Book of the Dead was written by an Afghani or an Indian great adept, yogi, who came to Tibet in the 8th century. But it was not made popular. It was written and then hidden. And it was not made popular in Tibet until the 14th century. So 500 years, even the Tibetans did not live within such a strong awareness of death in the general population. And furthermore, in India, where they'd had Buddhism by that time over 1,000 years, by the 8th century or more, like 1,500 years almost, there's no Book of the Dead in India. In other words, there's the knowledge of that in the Abhidharma, but there was no Book of the Dead for popular use. So why? Then I thought, and then we in America completely know such thing. So why did that culture develop the need for it, or the openness to it, or et cetera? And then, of course, I realized, why don't they want you to think about dying, your own death? Because then you won't be manipulable in all kinds of social schemes. And particularly in kingdoms, what is one, for men in particular, but women too, but especially men, Military is a big, important social scheme for the elite of societies in world history. And if people go and watch Platoon, you know, Oliver Stone's Platoon, or the equivalent, here we were doing a little platoon there, observing ourselves as a corpse. You know, then there, what is this, Johnny comes marching home, you know, you're not going to go out there and have yourself hacked to pieces if you can find a way out of it. You're not going to get all pumped up like, I'm going to be a patriot and save the world and go out and kill a bunch of people or get killed. You know, that, you know, then Johnny comes like carried home on a stretcher minus various limbs, mainly. If they're unlucky, they're just killed. And similarly, you're not going to work in a factory with deferred gratification for nothing and a pension. They're going to take your pension away. You'll be homeless at the end anyway. If you're really aware of your death, you want to have your moments of life be meaningful. It's incredibly liberating to be totally aware that you're, you know, like Carlos Castaneda used to write, or Don Juan said, if whoever Don Juan was, death is your advisor. It sits on your shoulder, you know, for the person of knowledge in those societies, you know, meaning that you use your life very meaningfully, and you're an individual, and you demand a certain freedom to use this precious human life to its great advantage. And so we have not been individualistic enough as a society or free enough to really be allowed to be aware of our death, because it would make us insubordinate to the corporate mentality. As Elizabeth Kubler-Ross famously said, after being with 10,000 people and helping them through the death transition, she's never met anyone who in those final hours or moments regretted not having spent another day at the office. I really like that. I think that's very, very brilliant. So in the way that the Tibetans meditate, and the elite Indians before that, but all of the Tibetans, is that, you know, that that we're going to die definitely, and that we don't know when, so it could be any time. So then every moment becomes something very, very meaningful, because it could be your last, you know. Right? I mean, heaven forbid, but you know, we drive down highways, and another huge 2-ton machine, minimum, even the truck is like 20 tons, comes racing by, and with the difference is maybe a foot. We think nothing of it. And we're going in a 2-ton thing at like 60 miles an hour, and this is coming at by aggregate speed 120 miles an hour. Completely flatten us instantaneously. And all it takes is somebody like lurching or tire blowing or something. So we always on this, we have live in this like unconscious, you know, hypnagogic state. That we're just a body, and like all we have to worry about is now until whatever is the average age, life expectancy. And we bravely do things that could put an end to life. We're not actually afraid enough. That's another very interesting thing in the Buddhist psychology. The Abhidhamma, fear is not one of the bad things. Fear is not among the kleshas, you know, the disturbing mental conditions or functions. Fear is considered a good thing. It is, you know, in the sense of caution, in the sense of being alert to reality, and in the sense of protecting, you know, our continuum as the precious human being alive here in the world, and able to use that mind to be free. How free really are we? Inventory the day. Well, Taratoko used to do that with us. Inventory your normal day, not day at Menla. Menla is like, relax. Your ordinary day. You sleep how many hours? You, if you're lucky, with or without this help. You spend time eating. You spend time shopping. You spend time preparing the meal. You spend time cleaning. You exercise, perhaps. to keep your body healthy from driving and sitting around too much. How many moments do you spend thinking about what you're really doing and who you really are in a day? 10? 20? 1 hour, let's say even 1 hour would be huge, I think. So then if you live another 40 years, 360, let's say some days you get no time at all, so say 300 hours a year, 40 times 300 is 12,000. Well, that's a lot, so hours are a lot. So 12,000 hours if you live another 40 years. If you live another 4 years, very little. 1,200 hours. So now you can't all stay at Menla forever. In this culture, there's not very few Menlas here, and where you could go and stay for a long time, unless you were really wealthy, and you would have like instruction, and you would have like support, and you would have very, very little. And it would be very costly for, in a way. This is why in a society like Tibet, they had so many monasteries. Monastery is an economically and socially the minimally expensive institution for people to be able to drop out of having to, you know, be stressed out. And be able, of course, they reproduce stress in monasteries. They have to cook for the monks, and they have to like prepare this and do that. And they reproduce it, and it's not that it's totally stress-free, but and they look inside to where the deep roots of stress are in the mind. But and so they're not lazy at all. They're not just, you know, sleeping there. But that's why they have those asylums. You know, it's like an asylum. Actually, in Europe, with the Reformation, according to the studies of various scholars, when they closed the monasteries in Northern Europe initially, and then eventually more spreading into the Catholic regions by counter-Reformation competition, they fairly soon started opening hospitals, asylums, you know, prisons. All of these things increased, these kind of institutions of people who couldn't fit into the rat race. Mental institutions, because you were considered, and I think still today to some extent, In psychology, you're considered defective if you don't want to go and slave away in a corporation or a factory all your life. If you don't want to be vicious and nasty and exploitive and competitive with other people, you're considered defective. Definitely at Exeter, if you wouldn't do that, you'd forget it. You should go back to some high school someplace. Do social studies and be nice. Where I went to school. So, let's have discussion. Shall we open to discussion? So I don't want to give it. We have only a few more minutes. Usually we stop at 11:30, but they have us going to 12 today, right? I heard somebody recite. You did. We read that for the paper. So what? What came up for anybody? Anybody doesn't want to be a corpse? Sorry. What? It says 12, right?
Yeah, but I guess lunch is served at 12, so we should really...
Well, maybe they're planning at 12:30 because they have another group or something. I don't know why they typed that, so they must have a reason.
It says 12 to 1 is lunch.
Oh, 12 to 1? Well, instant teleportation to lunch then. Well, we have a minute. Anybody has any question or lead into it later?
And there was a microphone.
There is a microphone right here on the floor. I don't know if it's hooked up on the thing there. But we'll hear you if anyone does.
I just have a comment.
Yes. What?
I just have a comment.
Oh, a comment, okay.
I would like to thank you for saying yes. For saying yes when you were asked if you wanted this place. Because I got as far as the garden, and when I saw the sign saying, "Welcome, come in," I was so profoundly grateful for this whole place that I started to cry.
Oh, how nice. Thank you. That's very nice. I'll tell my wife, who is struggling to finish that building there at the moment. Poor thing. But at least she doesn't have me bothering. You know, in her dream, I was myself hammering on the roof of these buildings, you see. And she was trying to tell me to get down because it made her nervous, and I wasn't listening. That was what was particularly. So I am listening, and I'm staying in my study, and I'm not, because I do like to do carpentry, and then I you know, I break things and whatever. Then, a little bit, but I've built a lot of things. I built a house.
The chainsaw.
Yeah, that's true. They used to call my children used to call me Dr. Chainsaw, because I used to trim, you know, beams. I built a post and beam house in Woodstock, and I used to trim beams standing on a ladder with a chainsaw and things like that. And then I didn't want to go back to Amherst to teach, you know, during those years when we were first building, at the end of the summers. So I would inevitably, within like 2 or 3 weeks of going home, I would develop a carpentry project. And so I would take the chainsaw and saw a door in the wall. And then it would be open to the elements, so we'd have to build a porch, and I'd have to, like, stress out and come back on the weekend to finish it and this kind of thing. Poor wife, really. She's a saint, I think. When she was pregnant with our third child, we had moved into our house, and we had no windows and no walls because it was post and beam, and the walls were not framed. You know, we had studs and posts, but no actual walls, surface of the walls. So we were, like, surfacing the wall around ourselves, you know. And she was in that nesting mode of being pregnant, you know. And when we were finally putting the shingles on one other part, we still didn't have glass in some of the windows, just plastic. And we were finally putting the shingles on one place. She was actually helping to do it, you know. But she was having trouble getting to the nail apron around the huge belly, you know. You know, when you do come, you have a nail apron. You have nails in there, and then the big belly was here, and she was like trying to find that nail, you know. It was an easy birth, actually, because it's good to work, actually. But people lie around too much when they're pregnant. In other countries, it's not so bad, the birth labor, because they've worked a lot. Okay, have a happy lunchtime.